Okay, Paddy, should I ask for questions and discussion now?
Yeah, please. Yeah, carry on.
Okay. Right. If you want to ask a question, please put a queue in the speaking queue and I will call you to speak. I wonder whether somebody's going to start. Right. I see Steve there. Steve, would you like to say something?
Yeah, thanks very much, Rich. Thank you very much, Richard. A very, very wide-ranging range of literature that you've talked about there. And I wonder whether some people are actually familiar with some of it. So we've got... I wonder if you wouldn't mind just expanding a little bit. For example, I don't think people realise maybe where Big Brother comes from. Or where doublespeak comes from. Yeah. So, some people may not. You know, I wonder whether you've assumed that people got more knowledge. And the issue of Animal Farm. If you could talk a little bit more about that. It's really interesting what you've said. But I think you made some assumptions that maybe people haven't got some of the knowledge that people haven't got necessarily.
Do you want to talk about Big Brother, Richard?
Yeah, okay. I think I'm trying to remember now where the Big Brother came from initially. There were some adverts, these posters you used to see, and it was some sort of, I don't know if it was a bookkeeping course, some sort of... like correspondence courses that are advertised, and they used to say, "Let me be your father," and then whoever this chap was, and then he died, and then they were, "Let me be your big brother." I'll have to check that out. That's literally where this Big Brother comes from. But the idea in 1984, Big Brother is the benevolent dictator. You could say somewhat modelled on Stalin, the great leader and teacher. And, of course, later on, he had Chairman Mao, whose picture appeared everywhere, and it became a sort of common thing in dictatorships, still going on in North Korea, really. But the idea was that Big Brother is looking after you and he's watching you. You can see everything that you do. And in 1984, you've got the telly screens, which, I mean, these days now we have surveillance of one form or another. And you've got the internet, you've got Google, you're collecting all this information about what you read, what you look at, etc., etc. You know, the security forces know about where you go, if your mobile phone's switched on, so on and so forth. So that was that's Big Brother as he appears in 1984, and everyone has to love Big Brother, and Winston Smith, a hero of 1984, despite all this resistance, eventually after he's been to room 101. Where it has rats, things he hates the most. He is a broken man, and he really does love Big Brother, confesses to all his thought crime. So that's how he features. I think that covers it. I'll stop there and wait for some more questions. Thanks.
Okay, Paddy, your turn.
I liked you when Richard was talking about what an irony that this writer of such real power. I mean, Orwell is, I think, famous, justly famous. It's just a really superb writer, one of the, you know, one of the best that Britain probably produced in the 20th century, and how he's been reduced to the bloody level of game shows, so that, like Steve says, you know, people use terms like Big Brother and Room 101, have not even got a clue where the terms come from. I do think that's quite funny, but it made me think when Richard was talking about how Orwell wasn't a socialist. He was just probably a bit of a wishy-washy liberal, if truth be known. And I was thinking back to many centuries ago when I was at school, and the three set books we had, the essays that we had to write were Compare and Contrast, 1984, and Brave New World. And I think generations of school kids got the same essay question to write. And the other one, the third in the triumvirate of horror stories, was Lord of the Flies. And it makes me think how much we were being brainwashed by the state deliberately picking these particular novels to give us a particular story, so that in 1984 we got the message, revolutions always produce nightmare dictatorships, and in Brave New World we've got the message, utopias are always shit, and in Lord of the Flies we've got the message, we're all basically shit, human nature is a Hobbesian horror story. And imagine us, the state, concentrating its power on the youth of every generation and feeding them this crap. And I just think in this particular sense, much as I admire George Orwell and in fact Golding as well, and Huxley, I think that they've committed a monstrous crime on the public zeitgeist and in public conceptions of politics and of human potential. I think that they've written stories that really have, you know, encapsulate the very worst propaganda that the capitalist class has been able to concentrate against the young minds of new workers. I think it's really quite I don't know. I think it's criminal that this has been done. And I think we should always bear in mind that, you know, great though these writers were, in another sense, politically, they were complete shites, and we should have no bloody time for them.
OK, Paddy, powerful. Mike, over to you now.
Thank you, yeah. Excuse me. Yeah, thank you, Richard. Yeah, that was a very interesting and informative reminder of Orwell's life. And yeah, he's one of my heroes. I love all of his writings. I've got a lot of time for him. Just to pick up on Paddy's point just now. Yeah, I did 1984 at school. And that would have been at the, you know, the sort of the time when there was that climate of, you know, nuclear war and the threat from the Soviet Russia. And I think, yeah, the reading of Orwell's 1984 at school was sort of coloured by that sort of background noise. I don't remember it being sort of its place being quite the same way as Paddy describes. I wouldn't go as far as Paddy just went. I didn't sort of feel it was taught in quite the way he describes to me. Just a couple of quick points. Orwell, as far as I know, only mentioned the SPGB once in his writings, and that was in a footnote to his essay about Hyde Park, you know, referring to Speaker's Corner, where I think in the footnote he just says the SPGB, a Marxist, he might use the word sect, with no connection to the Labour Party, and I think that's the only mention. I'd like to big up Keep the Aspidistra Flying, and maybe suggest that book indicated that Orwell had a bit more political awareness earlier than before he went off to Spain, Keep the Aspidistra Flying, was written in, I think, 1934-35. And it's about a brattish aspiring writer who has got a hatred of the money system, but he isn't focused enough to understand the economics behind it. So that there's the gap in the novel is the main character's class consciousness. It's all about sort of an angry young man who doesn't understand what he's angry about, as far as I can remember. But yeah, that's a great novel, and one that's not, you know, remembered quite so much. So yeah, I just wanted to put in a word for Keep the Aspidistra Flying. But yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, thank you.
Steve, back to you.
Yeah, thanks. I've got a slightly different opinion of Big Brother than Paddy. There's one aspect of the Big Brother that I think is really important current today, because you mentioned in your talk, Richard, doublespeak. And what, for those who aren't familiar, well, I can remember this, that the hero, Winston Smith, is employed in correcting history. And that what he does in his working day is he goes through old files, old articles, and removes anybody that's become an unperson. Paddy's just said newspeak, not doublespeak. But both come from this story, from this book. And what they're trying to, what one of the themes of Orwell's text is that the way that language is manipulated by the ruling class to restrict debate. And I think that exactly the same process is going on today. I don't know whether I mentioned it before on this forum, but if you look at what's happened recently in these so-called political debates, we've had Boris Johnson talking about get it done. The Labour Party talking about only not a few. It's been reduced. And in the States, it's make America great again. Before that, it was yes, we can. It seems to be that stuff is getting reduced to focus the political dialogue, or the political, won't use the word, to focus politics on an extremely minor points, which of course is a disaster for us, because our argument is so all encompassing that we cannot reduce it to this sort of nonsense level. But it's blocking ideas with the way that this becomes dominant in the media. Now, just think about it. If you listen to Radio 4, which I do, you go on and you listen to the news. At a particular, say over 2 weeks, they'll get ministers or shadow ministers coming on, and they will use the same bloody phrases all of the time. I say, get it done, have you? Or the Americans will say, make America great again. Yeah. So I think it's quite interesting his take on language and politics. Double plus on good, Steve. Thank you very much, Pat.
Thanks, Steve. Can't we reduce it to abolition of the wages system? But okay. Nobody else in the speaking queue at the moment. Given that, perhaps I could... Oh, yes, there is somebody now. Several people. Okay. Brian, you're next. Brian.
Just like the mention, to me, Orwell endorses in quite a few of his works, right? He endorses hierarchy. We see it in Down and Out, in Paris and London. And the other one then is also Animal Farm, endorsement of hierarchy, and especially so in 1984.
Okay. Adam, you next.
You know, Paddy mentioned Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. When you come to think of it, Huxley was more accurate about the future than Orwell. But we haven't got a dictatorship as Orwell, well, it wasn't predicting, was Orwell was describing. We've got something much more subtle than that, which is more Brave New World. So I think if you have to choose between which of them was predicting the future, I think you'd have to say Huxley was more accurate than Orwell. But I think the best, I mean, Richard said that Orwell wasn't all that interested in politics, but he was a member of the Independent Labour Party for about 2 or 3 years, and it was on its left wing. And he was familiar with arguments from the Trotskyists. In fact, in 1984, there's a character, Goldstein, who is, of course, Trotsky. But when Goldstein's views are expanded, it's expounded, it's about 3 or 4 pages, they're actually a criticism of the Stalinist Russia as a bureaucratic collectivism, as a new class society. But I think 1984 is an attack on Communist Party fellow traveling intellectuals, because, you know, the working class are just proles. They're just, you know, they're just there. But it's the people that suffer the intellectual brainwashing and all that. They're the cadres, and I think he was aiming at the people, you know, the intellectuals who were fellow travellers of the Communist Party, who put up with all this nonsense. You know, they just, Stalin said, "Turn, you support the Second World War, you don't support the Second World War," and they all turn as to what Stalin says. But I think the best of Orwell's political writings, as far as we're concerned, is Animal Farm. I mean, we don't need a pamphlet on Russia to explain. I mean, that Animal Farm, it does it all for us as to what happened in Russia. And in fact, when it was first written, they wouldn't publish it because it was still during the war, and you know, Stalin, Uncle Joe, and Stalin was one of the democratic nations fighting against fascism, and they suppressed a criticism of him. As I say, I mean, obviously people like homage to Catalonia, but I think Animal Farm is the best of his political writings, you know, from our point of view. But I mean, I agree with what everybody else has said about his style of writing. I mean, his essay Politics and the English Language, it should be read by everybody that writes for the Socialist Standard or anything else for that matter. Right.
Thanks, Adam. There's nobody actually in the queue, so I'll just say a quick word if that's okay. First of all, Animal Farm, yeah, it can be interpreted and often has been as an indictment of the Russian Revolution. However, it's also often been interpreted as an indictment of human nature. That's the trouble. I mean, like, you know, Orwell and Golding are often sort of put together as showing that, you know, human beings, if they can't cooperate, what will happen is if you put them in a sort of position of equality, some will take over, a hierarchy will develop, etc. That's a brilliant book, Animal Farm, brilliantly written, as all Orwell's works are. But the trouble is it's certainly susceptible to that interpretation. I've noticed that if I can just say another word or two, there are people in the queue now, but I might as well finish what I was going to say. That over the years, Orwell has been written about quite a lot in the Standard, in the Socialist Standard. Various articles have appeared. And I sort of noted down a quote from one here. And I wonder whether Richard could say whether he thinks it's sort of reasonable evaluation of Orwell. This quote says, "Politically, Orwell described himself as an anarchist at some times and a socialist at others. And both these avowals were qualified by a strong patriotism. He was not a socialist at all, of course. For him, the word carried simply connotations of decency, brotherhood, and the working man being admirable. Commentators invariably praise his refusal to accept political commitment as showing his integrity. Perhaps but it is also a luxurious position in which one has one's cake and eats it without having to think about the ingredients. I wonder, Richard, what you think about that?
Yeah, I'll talk now. That's great. And I've just seen this, what Vin's put on here from E.P. Thompson. This is interesting. About Orwell being sensitive to the insincerity on the left, but not the inhumanity of the right. Yes. Yeah, I think that's, Howard, what you quoted there is possibly a bit harsh, a bit unkind, but more generally true. Yeah, I mean, Orwell, obviously, like a lot of people, they change their minds, their views develop, and it's good of Adam to point out that, yes, he probably, Adam probably knows more than me that it wasn't true to say that I wasn't trying to make out as a political lightweight completely. I don't imagine him sitting down and reading lots of Marx and Engels, but he obviously had a good grasp of the politics. And I think, you know, all the various streams of the time, and this comes on in his 30s. Briefly mention that when Orwell was in Paris, he read We by Zamyatin. Now, I don't know how many people listening have heard of this. Zamyatin, Russian writer, who, I don't know if he went into exile. Anyway, he fell out of favour with the Bolsheviks. But he wrote this dystopia where everyone has numbers. They have a letter and a number. They don't have names anymore. They all live in this wonderful city. Everything is artificial. They never go out, or you're not really allowed out into the outside world. There's no, it's a complete dictatorship. Everything's very regulated, even though I remember there's something in there about music. Music's produced by machines, which is something we do have now, something that Orwell talked about. He put this into 1984 about the songs that the proles listened to were produced by machines. I've lost my thread now. Well, that's one influence on Orwell. It's very picked that up. Talking about Newspeak, I think there's like an appendix at the end of 1984. It talks about Newspeak, and what Orwell's saying then is with this new language, so many words have been removed. The idea is that you reduce the size of the language, so you can't express certain ideas and emotions, and ultimately the idea is that you can't have those thoughts because you have no way of voicing it. And so there's two paragraphs. Might it be the American Declaration of Independence? I think that's what it is. And then there's translated into Newspeak. It's like one sentence. All men are equal, and the rest of it, there's no equivalent in Newspeak. Yeah, there's an awful lot of stuff in there. The doublethink And the being able to hold two ideas at the same time and not see any contradiction. This is all was happening then and is even more so now. Yeah. I'm sorry, there's something else I meant to pick up on, but oh yes. Brian said about endorsing hierarchy. Now, yeah, probably that's interesting because in the book that Winston Smith reads, this forbidden book, I think it says about throughout history, society has always been divided into high, the middle, and the low. The idea that the middle, there's a revolution, the middle become the new high. A new middle develops. It's interesting. That's just being reminded of that. And the other thing. Oh dear, I've forgotten.
You can come back to me later.
Yeah. Please let's carry on. Let's hear some more from other comrades. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks. Right, I can see from Vin's what Vin's put in the speaking queue that E.P. Thompson obviously didn't like Orwell very much. It's a good one, though, I must say. Right,
Howard, excuse me. Can you just read out that text from Thompson, please? Because we've got members who can't.
They can't.
Can you just read that out, please?
Okay, I read it out. Yeah. It's a quote by E.P. Thompson, the historian, about Orwell. It says, "Orwell is sensitive, sometimes obsessionally so, to the least insincerity upon his left, but the inhumanity of the right rarely provoked him to a paragraph of polemic. To the right, decent people, average thinking person, every allowance. To the left, bearded fruit juice drinkers who came flocking towards the smell of progress like blue bottles to a dead cat. No quarter." Quite powerfully written. Okay, we'll go. Dave's next in the queue anyway. Okay, Dave. Are you there, Dave?
Thanks. Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Jolly good. Thank you. I wanted to say a little bit about Newspeak. And I thought that Richard just explained very well what Newspeak is and the purpose of Newspeak. And so, of course, basically, Newspeak, you with so much.
Sorry, could I interrupt? Dave, what are you doing to your microphone? We're getting some terrible crackling.
Okay, is that better, Paddy?
Yeah. Are you holding it or something? Because we're getting some terrible crackling.
I'm on my iPad. I tell you what, I'll put my iPad down.
Yeah, put it down, yeah, put it down, yeah.
There we go.
That's much better.
Okay, yep, no, that's fine. Sorry, Newspeak. So I just wanted to compare and contrast with the fact that there are lots of groups out there nowadays who want to put a restriction on the language that people use. So things like saying, you can't say that, that's racist. You can't say that, that's hate speech. You can't say that, that's Islamophobic. You can't say that, that's homophobic. You can't say whatever. It may not go as far as they were doing in 1984. But there are certainly attempts out there to reduce the language that people can use. Someone mentioned earlier, it might be you, Paddy, about slogans. I think it might be the Democrats in the American election are using a slogan. I think it's build better back. It's either build better back or build back better. But I think Boris might be using that as well. And I think that Moggy might be able to confirm this or not. They might even be using this slogan down in Australia. I'm not quite sure what build better back actually means. But as you said earlier, it's just reducing things to a slogan, isn't it? Which is slightly meaningless, basically.
Thanks, Dave. Okay, we've got Dougie next.
Hi, I read Promise to Catalina quite a few years ago, and that was Land and Freedom or whatever, which was based on Homage to Catalonia. I think Orwell was very much sickened by what happened with the Communist Party not supporting people and fighting for the Republic. And I think he sided mainly with the anarchists. I know he was in the PUM or whatever, but I think if you read Homage to Catalonia, he's very favourable about what the anarchists were trying to do. And also about slogans, I mean, all politicians seem to use slogans, from the Nazis to Donald Trump or whatever, you know, make America great, or, you know, and I mean, they do it in this country as well, get Brexit done, right? You know? So, I mean, it's nothing new, right? It's been going on for a long time, right? You know? So, yeah, but I mean, I quite like George Orwell's writing or whatever. I've read most of his stuff. He did write a book, My Country, Right or Left or whatever, so he was a bit of a nationalist, and he did talk about democratic socialism, and I think what he meant was a sort of left-wing Labour government, really. He joined the ILP. When he was out in Spain, I think there was about 25 or 28 ILP members went off to fight in the Spanish Civil War, so he maybe met some of them when he was in Spain, but I'm not sure about that, really.
I think it was My Country, Right or Wrong, Dougie. Mike, you now.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, just reading that quote from E.P. Thompson again, and yeah, it's a bit harsh. I mean, when he says that Orwell ignores the inhumanity of the right, I think, you know, he's forgetting hello. All right. When Orwell is you know, writing about dictatorships and totalitarianism, you know, that's partly an attack on aspects of the extreme right, and again, his earlier writings focusing on poverty, you know, down and out in Paris and London, and A Clergyman's Daughter especially, Burmese Days, that's quite anti authority as well. So yeah, I think there are wider attacks on the right wing and the effects of the right wing, such as poverty, in plenty of Orwell's writing. So yeah, I think E.P. Thompson's a bit harsh. Just quickly as well, the one Orwell novel which I haven't really got, I've read it, but I couldn't quite get what Orwell was getting at, is Coming Up for Air, which is about sort of the approach to the Second World War and a sort of a feeling of nostalgia for a time before. It didn't seem as political as I expected it to be when I read it. So I don't know if there was something I was missing in Coming Up for Air. So yeah, I'd be interested if anyone else knows more about that book than myself. Yeah, thank you.
Paddy, it's you again now.
I read Coming Up for Air and I can't remember a damn thing about it, I'm afraid. So that probably says something, doesn't it? I was just thinking that I mentioned before how we all had to write essays about comparing Brave New World and 1984. I don't know how many people know this, but one of the most famous people who also wrote an essay comparing Brave New World and 1984 was the author of Brave New World, Aldous Huxley. And he did this in a book called Brave New World Revisited, and I remember reading this some years ago. And it's really quite interesting because it was written, I think, in about the mid-60s or possibly a bit later than that. And in this, Huxley's just taking on the classic sort of, O-level essay question, as it was at that time, and revisiting it. And of course, well, by a strange coincidence, he finds his own book infinitely superior to Orwell's book in uncountable ways. But it's quite an interesting read. He does point, and he is right to some to a large extent. I mean, we didn't see the sort of things that Orwell was warning against in 1984, except in the way that Richard mentioned, you know, Room 101 and things like that return as ridiculous game shows. That's the only kind of way that they've reappeared. And we haven't seen anything, despite what people are saying about politicians prattling phrases, they've always done that. We haven't seen Newspeak or anything like it. In fact, I just checked now, and according to the OED, the OED adds roughly 1,100 new coinages to the English language every year. The language is growing. English is actually the biggest language in the world in terms of vocabulary anyway, but it adds 1,100 every year. Of course, old ones go extinct as well, but there's no sign of this sort of totalitarian control over mind and language that Orwell was talking about. But of course, he was warning, wasn't he? It was more of a warning to posterity rather than an actual prediction, whereas Huxley was predicting. And some of the things that Huxley talked about, soma culture or drug culture, that's not really come true. And yet, in another sense, you know, drug culture is part of modern society much more than it was back in the 1950s. This idea of spending is better than mending, that definitely is true. When the lockdown finished, there were queues around the block to get into Primark. Primark is the sort of place that sells cheap clothes, sort of knocked up in Pakistan, Dakar sweatshops that you can only wear once or twice because they fall to bits. You know, and it's all about spending is better than mending. So he was dead right. He was dead right there. And of course, genetic engineering. That's we're still seeing that appear. So we can just imagine a situation where, you know, the rich genetically engineer their children through CRISPR gene technology. That's still on the rise now. So, so his book was called Brave New World Revisited. Can't remember when it was, but it's quite an interesting read if you're interested in comparing those two novels today and see how they stack up. There you go.
Thanks, Paddy. Can I just mention that Steve pointed out that maybe some people, depending on the device they're using, who can't actually see the speaking cue. If there are such people and they want to speak, I would say just interrupt and, you know, you'll be fitted in. Okay, right. Next in the queue is Adam.
Yeah, just want to second Mike's defence of Orwell against E.P. Thompson. Now, E.P. Thompson was a Stalinist hack until Hungary when he left the Communist Party. So Orwell was precisely criticising people like him, intellectuals who'd remained in the all its zigs and zags, all its twists and turns from, you know, in the 1940s, all praises of Stalin and all that. I mean, that, so it obviously hit home with E.P. Thompson getting his revenge. I mean, as I say, I think Orwell was completely right, and Thompson is wrong. But the other thing, of course, which I tend to agree with Orwell on, he was in the ILP and he met all these peculiar people, you know, vegetarians, nudists, sandal wearers and so on. I mean, they're people like that. We don't have many in our party, but I mean, they just discredit a socialist party. So I would defend Orwell's criticism of them as well. We want to be ordinary, middle-of-the-road people like most people, not strange people with odd views. So I think, you know, I'm 100% behind Orwell's criticism of the sort of people that were in the ILP, and certainly I'm 100% or 110% behind his criticism of all those people that supported the Communist Party, like E.P. Thompson, Christopher Hill, and there are a lot of other ones. I mean, after they left the Communist Party, they became, you know, a bit better. But remember, during that period of the 1940s and early 50s, they were still in this house.
Sorry, I don't think you heard me then, because I was muted. What I wanted to say is, before we go to Vin, if there is anyone who can't get onto the speaking queue and would like to speak, speak now. Right, there isn't anyone by the looks of it. So over to you, Vin.
Okay, Adam. No, I would disagree with a fair amount of that. Yeah, I mean, Thompson, yeah. I mean, he was a Stalinist. I mean, later life, yeah. I mean, I'm an admirer of his book on Morris, for example. However, be that as it may, I think Orwell, you know, from time to time, Orwell did not have talked shit. I mean, I'm thinking, say, of, you know, like his, when he, you know, in The Road to Wigan Pier, he does clearly express, you know, these are prejudices that as an old Etonian I was brought up with, you know, the idea, you know, the only thing we knew about working people was the working class's smell. And he kind of brought that with him. And also he spent time in sort of very filthy doss houses. And his impression of the working class was very peculiar. But the thing is with Orwell, and by the way, I was going to say that actually I've read Coming Up for Air, and I like it. And it's not as Mike said, a nostalgia for the past more. It was a kind of warning. I mean, it's about a man who tries to relive his past and finds what an empty idea that was. But there are kind of early indications of 1984 in it. You know, he's sort of like, this is a man who's, you know, the war's about, the Second World War's about to start, and he can see the things that he writes about in 1984. He describes, you know, I can see people's faces, in people imprisoned and stuff. It's quite an interesting book, and also quite an easy read. But going back to what I was going to say about Orwell, he's also very easily misquoted. I mean, I was guilty of that by just sort of like putting in one thing of Thompson, because Thompson wasn't completely disparaging about Orwell. This was just something relating to what Adam had said earlier. But I mean, as it happens, I read the other day, he wrote in a review on Mein Kampf, he wrote something like, I can't bring myself to dislike Hitler. And actually, I came across Christian YouTube where this sort of like bloke said something like, George Orwell, you know, you'll have only heard of one or two books of his. You know, he was very patronising, but he sort of went on about this. I mean, what Orwell was saying there was that Hitler portrays a kind of pathos. You know, it's like if he kills a little mouse, it's as if he's just slain a dragon. And there's this this way that he's being put across is very like the way you see sort of pathos in the cinema, which is all meant to be very appealing. So I suppose what I'm to pull all this together is that when you're coming across Orwell, there's lots of places where you can really have a go and think, for God's sake, Orwell, yeah, prejudice, you know, what are you saying? And that has to be in with, you know, all the really serious issues that he took on. That's enough from me.
Thanks, Vin. Next in the queue, Anne.
Oh, Howard, it's Keith masquerading as Anne.
Okay, go on, Keith.
Yeah, we're both on the same machine.
All right.
It's a really interesting discussion, this, and I think what it's bringing out is how many-sided Orwell was. And how, you know, there are some things to admire and other things to deplore about him. I do agree with the people who've mentioned the quality of his writing, the quality of his prose. Somebody described it as prose like a window pane. It's absolutely clear. It's crystal clear. You know what Orwell is saying. You don't have to dig down to find out. There's an absence of bullshit. So that you get the message straight. That's on the plus side. On the negative side, I mean, there's a certain kind of priggishness about it. And I mean, you can agree that E.P. Thompson was in all a lot of ways an asshole without thinking that exonerates Orwell from criticism of the way he expresses himself. And to get the full flavour of it, It's worth getting the whole quotes, and they come from mostly from The Road to Wigan Pier, and they're about, I mean, look, listen to what he says. He says socialism draws towards it with magnetic force every fruit juice drinker, nudist, sandal wearer, sex maniac, Quaker, nature cure quack, pacifist and feminist in England. And he goes on a rant about such cranks elsewhere, talking about vegetarians with wilting beards, the outer suburban creeping Jesus, eager to begin his yoga exercises, and that dreary tribe of high-minded women and sandal wearers, and again, bearded fruit juice drinkers. Who, and then we got the rest of the quote originally from on the site. And you can't help thinking, what a prig, what a narrow-minded person. Why is he picking on all these completely irrelevant attributes? So take what you can guess. I mean, the praise is an example for all of us. And for me, that's what's good about it. Just one other thing, coming up for air. So I've forgotten who it was in the discussion who said they'd forgotten the book. I'm not surprised. The problem with that book is it's about a man who's being bored. And the trouble is, it turns out into a boring book as well. Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Keith. Vin, you've got something to say again. Carry on.
Oh, yeah, no, I disagree. I didn't find it boring at all. But, but the point is, yeah, all those quotations, you know, he's wrong. Those, you know, vegetarians, sandal wearers are not the preserve of the left. You know, there's just as many, you know, there's just as many right wingers with these sort of peculiar, you know, idiosyncrasies. And, you know, this is kind of an example of, you know, of Orwell being just completely bloody prejudiced.
Thanks, Vin. Adam?
I'm just saying, I love that quote from Orwell, and I'm always using it because I think it is relevant. We want to avoid that image at all costs. But one thing the other thing I won't forgive him for is the thing about the working class smell in the Road to Wigan Pier. But when the war broke out, he denounced the opponents of it as fascists. And that I won't forgive him. That's what I'll hold against him. But I won't hold against him as his remarks about bearded vegetarians and sandal wearers and fruit juice people. Anyway.
Howard, you're muted.
Howard, you're muted.
Very sorry. Thank you very much. Paddy, it's you now.
I don't know. Adam and I have argued about this a number of times, but I tend to think that if you add up all the eccentricities, if that's what you want to call them, I'm not sure that I would call vegetarianism an eccentricity, or even naturism, to be honest. I mean, it's really common in Germany and lots of European countries. But I mean, if you added up all these eccentricities and excluded them all because they would discredit the Socialist Party, I think you'd basically exclude virtually all of the working class. I think if anyone's out of step here, it's Adam, and it was also George Orwell for his snobbishness. But George Orwell had the excuse that he was writing in the 1930s. Adam doesn't have that excuse.
Devastating, Paddy. Okay, Nigel, you now.
Thank you. It always makes me laugh to hear people criticise George Orwell for saying the kind of things he did about the left always attracts the sandal-wearing, non-meat-eating person. Because I always remember... At least I think I remember when Frederick Engels was explaining why the Communist Manifesto was called the Communist Manifesto and not the Socialist Manifesto, was that Engels said that when it was written, 1847, beginning of 1848, actually I think it was published at the beginning of 1848, but it was written in 1847. But Engels explained that the reason why it was called the Communist Manifesto, not the Socialist Manifesto, was because at that time there were so many reformist groups and so many people who were out and out reformists. And if I'm not mistaken or misremembering this, Engels described them as people who were, Fagin's and Hole in the Wall reformists of every shade. And I think, I don't want to sort of misquote him here, but I think he used all sorts of terms like Orwell used. So, you know, Orwell was only 100 years too late as far as that is concerned. The other quick point I want to make is, actually, I've just remembered my favourite quote from George Orwell, which is that at 50, everyone has the face they deserve, which always makes me laugh. But one thing I think Orwell is, well, I think Orwell's known for two things. One is, I think he has definitely hindered socialist ideas in the sense that everyone who thinks of the totalitarian state, I don't think they think about the Nazis or Mussolini or Franco. I think they always think of so-called communism in the Soviet Union. And I really do think it's a drawback, and I think Orwell is definitely responsible for that. Certainly a lot of his quotations are worth remembering and thinking about. But the one quote that I've heard a few people mention was in regard to patriotism. Because I've always, again, I think I've misremembered this, because I always thought that Orwell had said that my country, right or wrong, was the same as saying my mother, drunk or sober. In other words, that he was actually opposing patriotism and nationalism in saying that. That's just a couple of wee points I wanted to make there. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Nigel. There's nobody in the queue at the moment. Richard, do you want to pick up on anything that that people have said since you last spoke?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm never quite sure about this, my country, right or wrong, or right or left. But what Nigel said might explain it, yeah. I think Orwell has this sort of strange relationship with his country. And I think possibly his ideas of his sort of view of a socialist Britain was that we're just changing the important things, you know, improve the lot of the workers. We want, you know, better distribution of wealth, you know. So he's in favour of the health service and progressive tax and so on and so forth. And I think he was very anti private education at one time, the education that he'd had or needed. He was a teacher for a brief period and tried out some progressive ideas which didn't go down too well. And these appear in A Clergyman's Daughter. That book is quite not very well, not many people have read that, I don't think. But there's some worth a look at. You have to remember that Orwell was a man of his time and place, and so he has prejudices, and I tend to laugh at this stuff about all the eccentrics, you know, people crawling out from under a stone. But I think the point he was making is that it was harming getting across a socialist message to the vast majority, and that socialist was becoming equivalent to some sort of eccentric. And I know I remember this in The Road to Wigan Pier, you know, that the words have become synonymous. I think there's something about he's on a bus somewhere, probably in the Hertfordshire countryside, because he would have been living at Wallington at that time, near Baldock. So he probably stopped at Bungler somewhere, and a couple of feathers get in shorts and sandals, and you overhear someone saying, "Warm socialists," and they're meaning some sort of weirdo, eccentric. They're probably, you know, vegetarians who do yoga exercises, which was a very strange thing to do in the 1930s, both of those things. And now they're not. But, I mean, I think he's, you find, you know, he's come from a cloistered, middle-class, rural English background. He's gone to the, he goes to work in the empire and he sees how his own people, his colleagues are treating the natives and thinks that's awful. And then he sort of comes back to this country and realises that, you know, the British ruling class, the officials, you know, authority treat the natives, so to speak, the workers in Britain the same way. And he'd never, and it's sort of, he hasn't really appreciated that until this time. Ping, and he discovers things. And one of the things he talks about in the Road to Wigan Pier is he had no idea what coal miners' wages were. He always imagined they were quite well paid. And then he presents these facts and figures. And he's clearly, it's a great shock to him. And he wants to bring this across to a lot of people that had no idea that, you know, when they get that the coal arise and everybody was needing it in those days for the heating and cooking, just what someone has had to go through to get that coal to them out of the ground. Right, I'll stop there because I can see more in the queue. So let's carry on. Thanks.
Okay, Richard. Should we let Dougie, you now?
Yeah, it's my country, right or left, the title of the book. And
Very sorry about that. Okay.
Oh, it's okay. It's okay. Don't worry about it. Yeah. I quite like George Orwell. I know 1984 can be used to slag off Stalinism and things like that. And communism leads to that. And it gets into workers' minds that it's no good. I remember arguing with somebody and he said any idea about utopianism always goes wrong because, you know, look what happened in Russia. And a lot of workers think that, you know, and books like that don't help that much, really, you know. But you've got to put your faith in, you know, the majority of people sorting society out in their own interest, really, you know. And that's all we can say to people when they say it always goes wrong, really. Some people say they'd rather have the middle road, you know, the lesser of two evils, like a Labour Party rather than a Conservative Party. And I've argued with people that put forward that idea, and they get that from books like Brave New World and George Orwell and 1984 and things like that.
I'm seeing the comments on the speaking queue page, and people are obviously having a bit of fun. I wonder whether we are, there are no queues in the speaking queue. So I wonder whether we're coming to a natural end. Don't know what you think, Paddy.
Yeah, sure. If people, I don't know. I think it seems to be going quite well. I mean, if people want to carry on a bit longer,
it's been a good discussion. But as I say, there are no queues in there are no people in the queue at the moment. Maybe people have said sort of everything they want to say. At this point, I mean, Rich has given us a good run for our money as well.
Yeah, well,
any,
yeah.
Any more for any more or forever? Hold it.
I'm just wondering now whether a good run for particularly appropriate for a socialist party meeting.
Sorry about that. Well, I'll let you conclude, maybe, Paddy.
Well, that seems to be, I think that was a good discussion. I think everybody's really, really grateful to Richard for giving that talk. It was really good. It stimulated a good discussion.
Can I just say, Danny has written on the speaking queue, I'll have a word. You want to speak, Danny?
All I wanted to say was thanks very much for an interesting discussion. and something I've been listening to, and I've met the wind once in the whole hour. So thanks very much. I've enjoyed it.
Okay.
Cheers. See you as well.
Right, so we'll see you all next week then, hopefully.
You'll certainly hear from me.
Thanks very much, everyone.
Thanks for cheering it, Howard.
Cheers. Bye. Thanks a lot.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Richard.